And welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, where we talk journalists and journalism. We are coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Chrysanthi Giodis. It's been a wild ride of a week in the arts and humanities. First, last week on Friday, the government announced its shake-up in the funding model for the university sector. More places are to be offered to Australian students, but the money tap is not necessarily being turned on or being maintained across all degrees. One key part of the plan that has caused a great deal of anger is the cost of a degree in the humanities, which will rise sharply and, depending on the subject studied, could go up by some 113%. Clearly, the message being sent by a conservative government that believes in price signalling was don't be silly and study the humanities. This move on the humanities and also the killing off of ABC Life feeds into this week's edition of Fourth Estate, where we ask what is the state of our culture and lifestyle reporting in this country and how does or does it not fit into the idea of public interest journalism. To make the question even clearer, should public interest journalism be all about viewing the state of our nation solely through the lens of policy, economics and national security? And in doing so, are we missing something fundamental about not just our public life, but our community as well? Fittingly, we asked this question on the day that the government bowed to pressure from many sections of society and finally announced some COVID relief funding for arts organisations. To help us in this important discussion, we're joined by three experienced journalists, all with a bent for the arts. Stephanie Convery is the Deputy Culture Editor at The Guardian. She has worked extensively as a freelancer, as well as being a former Deputy Editor for Overland Magazine. She's author of After the Count, The Death of Davy Brown, a fascinating discussion of boxing as art and sport culture. Stephanie, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Sasha Molitoritz is Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the Centre for Media Transition, where I am very lucky to have him as a colleague and we have many great culture conversations. In a previous life, he was feature writer for the Sydney Morning Herald, having started as a news cadet. Sasha, I'm giving this away, way back in 1994.
All good.
Sasha Molitoritz. Hi, Sasha. I'm just about to give a plug for your book, Net Privacy, How We Can Be Free in an Age of Surveillance. Sasha, welcome back to Fourth Estate.
Thanks, Chrysanthi.
And Bernard Zuhl is a freelance writer and music critic who is very well known to anyone who has ever taken an interest in music in New South Wales. He has worked at the Sydney Morning Herald for over 25 years. Much of the time as senior reviewer and critic. Bernard, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Hello.
All right. Before we get into the heart of our discussion, I'd like to ask the panel their thoughts on the news that ABC Life is no more. Yesterday, the ABC announced 250 job losses across the entire organisation. One key loss announced was the abolishing of ABC Life, with half of the jobs in this area soon to be gone. What remains will go into ABC Local and be rebooted as a regional platform. So, in the end, ABC Life's life will be as short as it was controversial. It started under former ABC Managing Director Michelle Guthrie, and from the beginning it was under attack from all quarters, even those who would call themselves friends of the ABC, questioning if scant resources should be spent on lifestyle journalism. It was also attacked by commercial media unhappy with the perceived competition. So, the question, is the death of ABC Life indicative of the low value of lifestyle journalism or just another battle in the culture wars? Stephanie, can I start with you? What did you think of ABC Life and did it deserve to die the way that it has?
Oh, well, I will answer the first one. The second question first, I absolutely don't think it deserved to die in the way that it has. I do think that this is another iteration of the culture wars, but I do also think it's important to see the cut specifically to ABC Life in the context of that broader culture war. I mean, it's been a thing. It's been observable at the ABC over the last decade just how much their general cultural analysis and coverage has reduced. So if you particularly look at the arts for a start, like they almost have no arts coverage now. There are a few people like employed in the arts there, but it just doesn't exist in the same way that it did even 10 years ago. So the arts is very, very thin on the ground at the ABC now. And a couple of years ago when ABC Life started, it wasn't arts coverage, but it did kind of fill a space that a more kind of in-depth cultural unit would have filled. And the destruction of that now, to me, looks like they are the biggest target in a culture war that previously decimated the arts. That's how I see it. And I think it is. I think it's absolutely true that it's going to be a massive blow for diversity of viewpoints, of culture in the ABC itself and in the media more generally. I know those people who worked there were doing such hard work trying to bring new voices into a mainstream media that is very white and very monolithic. And I think it's a real problem that they are the first to go in another wave of cuts.
Yeah, that's such a great point. I mean, I'm looking at some output from ABC Life and there's just some incredible stories from really diverse perspectives. Bernard, do you have something on this?
Well, I think the answer to your question is yes and yes. It was clearly a target in the culture wars because it represented culture. It represented the broad culture we have and the monoculture that dominates the media, both within the ABC and outside the ABC, was threatened by it because it's different, because it had different faces, because it was new and brought in new voices and new perspectives. And so automatically it was a threat. And the broader issue of other media feeling threatened by the ABC encroaching on their territory, which goes to news and culture and even to the small extent that the ABC covers arts, the arts as well. I mean, that plays into all this, but at its root, it's a case of being frightened by the possibility that the perspectives that have dominated will no longer do so. And the problem with cutting it within the ABC is I can see value in some of the cuts that have been made in the sense of showing exactly what hurts and what will hurt you as a listener and viewer of the ABC. For example, getting rid of 7:45 a.m. news. That's a major blow that doesn't pretend anymore that the taking away money from the ABC can be covered by everybody just doing twice as much for half the money and half the time. But getting rid of ABC Life is partly a sop to the critics and a way that the ABC has been acting for some time, which is sort of preemptive buckling. Let's get rid of something before it becomes a bigger issue for us all, so it avoids us getting another angry op-ed in The Australian. But it also adds to the debate within the ABC of what's important and what's valuable, and that is an issue that the ABC hasn't grappled with properly for some time, much as the rest of the media hasn't really, but the ABC, we ask much more of it, and this is an area where they have to lead, and they're not.
That's such a great point about what's important and what's valuable. And Sasha, I mean, I'm looking at stories here from ABC Life, you know, a timely story on talking to young people about racism. I've got stories about diversity and, you know, single mothers during COVID losing their village, you know. If we can get on to this idea of public interest journalism, the ACCC defined public interest journalism as the primary purpose of recording, investigating and explaining public policy and issues of public interest or significance. It's long, I'm keep going, with the aim of engaging citizens in public debate and informing democratic decision making. Is this a narrow definition that leaves cultural life out in the cold? And what are the potential flow-on effects?
Look, that's a good question. And yes, it is a narrow definition, but also the ACCC themselves have recognised that that's a narrow definition and they are opening to broadening it. And that's a very live discussion that's going on, you know, at the moment. And can I come back to that in a second? Because I just want to add to what Stephanie and Bernard both said. I think what's happening at the ABC with the budget cuts as a response to government funding cuts over the past few years that have just been savage is appalling, right? And I come at this, you know, I second what was just said, but I come at this from another angle as well, and that is through the prism of trust, right? And so trust in journalism. And we have this crisis of trust, if you will, or at least this real problem with diminishing, falling levels of trust in news in particular, but also in media generally. And it goes together with falling levels of trust in government and in institutions generally. But if we focus on news, in Australia, the ABC, closely followed by SBS, are far and away the most trusted sources of news. And this is despite the fact that they're contentious, you know, and they're politically unpopular, particularly among conservatives. So given all that, the ABC is far and away the most trusted source of news and an incredibly well-trusted media source. So in these times of misinformation and turbulence and people being overwhelmed by sources of information, the ABC's role is more important than ever, and yet it's just suffering these funding cuts. It's, you know, the 7:45 bulletin is going. And I just think that is completely unwarranted and awful for the cultural, for the information landscape of Australia. So that's kind of, for me, a really important way to view it all through that prism of trust. But to come back to your question about public interest journalism, this is a really important question at the moment, because this might have slipped by a lot of people, and it's huge news, but it's kind of happening in the background, and that is the ACCC, the market regulator, is currently working on a bargaining code, a mandatory bargaining code, and as part of that, it may turn out that Facebook and Google have to pay a significant sum of money to news providers. And the question there becomes, okay, so who is going to get this money? What sort of news will get this money? And it seems probable that public interest journalism will be a significant part of what gets money. So do we count cultural journalism, arts journalism, as public interest journalism? Yeah, my view is that I think we have to. We can't just think about journalism in terms of, we can't just think of public interest journalism just in terms of what saves and aids democracy. We need to think beyond that about what builds community, about what enriches culture. I think we need to think about public interest journalism in a more expansive way, and make sure it is well funded.
Stephanie, you are deputy culture editor for The Guardian. Would you take exception at your journalism not being considered public interest?
Absolutely. I don't think anybody who's worked as an arts journalist would say that their work is not real journalism or is not in the public interest. I do certainly think there is a difference between, say, the writing of fiction and the writing of journalism, as like one is in the public interest in a different way. You know, that journalism is journalism, and that it encompasses a big umbrella. It's a big umbrella that encompasses a lot of kinds of writing, television programs, radio programs. There's a lot of kinds of media that come under that umbrella as well. The idea that it's not in the public interest to talk about community, to talk about the cultural products of those communities, to talk about art, to me, kind of goes against my entire life's work, I have to say, but it is also selling the public short. It's saying that the only thing that should matter to them doesn't include, the only things that should matter to them don't include all of these things that do actually matter to people. I do think it is interesting to sort of think about that more generally, what is in the public interest, but also what the government thinks is in the public interest. I mean, if sometimes I think if this government had its way, the only thing that would be in the public interest is the economy. And clearly that is not the only thing that people care about or are interested in or feel like they need to know about. But you can't measure something like the arts solely by its contribution to the economy. You have to have other markers by which you measure these things. Sometimes they're not quantifiable. So I do think this is a really complex question, what is in the public interest. But I do also think that it's like journalism is quite clearly a practice of bringing stories to the public that are of interest to them. And anything that falls under that umbrella, as far as I'm concerned, is part of that.
So this is a really interesting question, because there's the of interest and in public interest debate. So you have actually, you mentioned the economy. There's research out by the Australian Institute which talks about the fact that For every $1 million in turnover, arts and entertainment produce 9 jobs, while the construction industry produces 1 job. And we had today the discussion, the announcement, the very welcome announcement of funding for arts and culture organisations. I think that the journalism that you guys do actually contributes to the existence of those organisations. So, for example, how would we know, how would anyone living outside of Bankstown know about the incredible Bankstown Poetry Slam? Bernard, if your bio is to be believed, you started out on local street presses and a Penrith local paper. How important is that really local level of support for up-and-coming cultural producers?
It's vital in the example you use of the Bankstown Poetry Slam. And those things aren't going to be covered by major media. They're not going to be covered by radio stations based in the city. They're going to struggle to even get to some community stations who have other objectives. So without a local impetus, without a local environment, things won't exist. Things can't be sustained. And by sustain, I mean not just keep going themselves with the drive to make the art or the cultural contribution they're making, but also the sheer practicality of space and money and time. When I worked in local paper, it felt part of the community. It felt like something that people would use in some way. But at the same time, it was a fairly small part of their life. Most people don't contribute in any way to their local communities. They don't get involved in too many things happening around, except for things like sport and maybe things that their children might be involved with. And that goes to things like the local newspaper. Most people don't pick up the paper and look at it. If they do, they might flick through really quickly and move on. So there is an issue there of how much we value those things and how much we use them. But as with the ABC and some of the things that have been cut from the ABC in recent years, those things only start to matter when they're not there. And this is the other problem we have, that if we're talking about the value of things, until it's absent, most people aren't going to give it any thought. That's why I have something of a problem with the arguments that have been made in the past decade using financial, economic basis for the defence of things like the arts. I think it's important. It's got to be there in some way. But the truth of it is that just doesn't wash. The people who are making decisions about reducing coverage of the arts, funding to the arts, support for the arts and broader culture don't care that it produces jobs. They have an issue with it philosophically and ideologically. And if you're arguing with people on an economic basis, it doesn't work. It just hasn't worked. We're not seeing real response to the idea that the arts and culture produce jobs in a greater proportion, a multiplier than mining.
So basically we're arguing on their terms when actually we should be arguing on the terms that this is of value, full stop.
Well, I think we need to argue on both grounds, and I think we're struggling to mount the this is important argument, possibly because we've put a lot more effort into this is financially a major contributor to the world and to our economy. Because, as you said, we're fighting on their ground, and I don't think that's a ground, first of all, that they're prepared to see, but also that people see arts in that way. I don't think people see arts who consume art. I don't think they see it in economic terms. And the people who do live in economic terms don't care.
If I can jump in there and just say I absolutely agree with that. I think that one of the biggest problems the arts community and people who love the arts have at the moment is they cannot articulate that intrinsic argument for the arts. They always fall back on the economic argument, and it isn't getting them where they want to go. And I really think that is an imperative that the arts community needs to kind of step up to urgently. It needed to happen 20 years ago. We need to be able to rediscover why, like, that argument about why the arts are fundamentally important for their own sake, not just for their effects on the community.
Couldn't agree with that more. Just to jump in on the jump in. Stephanie, you used that phrase, life's work. You know, I think that's really important. You know, for you, the arts is clearly your life's work, as you said, Bernard. You and I work together covering music and other cultural topics. I know it's your life's work. It was mine too until I took a left-hand turn into academia. And I totally agree. There is so much intrinsic worth to culture and to then journalism about culture. And we have to do a better job of telling that. I remember even at the Herald, all those years that I was there, there was this kind of hierarchy that news, hard news, was what really mattered. You know, that was what was really important at the Sydney Morning Herald, where the stuff that Bernard and I focused on and which we were passionate about, you know, music, films, the arts generally, feature writing more broadly, you know, this was so important to us, and yet it was not considered so important by the powers that be at the Herald, even though in a lot of cases it was actually what was bringing the advertising revenue to the paper and readers, you know, so there was that great irony.
To add to that, Sasha, I think the issue with the Herald is replicated across media generally, and similar to the way that within the ABC there was so much criticism of ABC Life that then leaked out into a broader discussion. Within media, the idea of arts culture being serious news, being worthwhile covering, exists still and is just as strong. I mean, you see it in, this is a bit of a bugbear of mine, but you see it in things like the Walkley Awards, who up until 3 years ago didn't even cover arts in any way, and since then have bludgeoned into doing something. But within that, you're looking at people making decisions there who have very little involvement with the arts and with culture. Then the decisions on who's nominated, things like that, are similar to the way decisions are made in most newspapers. And I'm not speaking of The Guardian, I don't have experience there, but certainly in the places that I've worked or have been in contact with, the decisions are made by people for whom culture is possibly the movie they see once a month. Maybe if they're in senior position, the opening night that they're invited to because they're the editor of the paper or something like that. They don't engage with arts and culture beyond their narrow interests, and they don't believe then that it's that important or that serious. And so you hit this problem within media before you even get to people outside media who might bring some influence to politicians or to the way arts is received.
Speaking as an employee of The Guardian, I mean, it is a priority for us to cover the arts and culture and cover arts and culture and to do so in a way that treats it as just as important as all the other things that are happening in the world. It is an issue of resources that we often come up against. We are a very small outfit, comparatively speaking, and so we do our best with not very much. But it is, I think, a legacy issue for the media more generally about like not treating arts coverage as serious as other kinds of coverage. I think I definitely agree with that. I think we are sort of fighting like an inherited bias against what is seen as like fun and not important because it might be enjoyable. Something like hard politics. But the arts is involved in hard politics. This is another example. Like the ABC cuts, but they're always targeting those soft, supposedly easy targets like the arts and things. And obviously other parts of the organisation have been cut too. But you see it first always in the arts. They're the first targets. It's inherently political to me.
And also the arts deal with a lot of political issues, right? So we've got these incredible artistic products that show a mirror to ourselves. And then you, in your jobs, actually reflect that out and talk about that to the wider cultural community in Australia, the wider community, full stop. You're listening to Fourth Estate on the Community Radio Network. Our guests this week are Stephanie Convery, Dr. Sasha Molitoritz, and Bernard Zuhl. We've covered quite a lot already, but the problem of casualisation of jobs in journalism is that it's most apparent when one looks at culture and lifestyle reporting, where a large slice is done by freelancers and casuals. Sasha and Bernard, this is very different from when you started out. Can I get you to talk about what support you got and how it helped you? Bernard, can I get you to start?
Well, actually, interestingly, I don't think it's that different to when I started out. I'm considerably older than most of you, I think. But the idea of covering arts and culture really only happened well, seriously, in the 90s. Before then, it was a casual thing. It was the junior person in the office. Going back to the 50s and 60s, the youngest person in the office was considered to be the person who would cover the visiting pop star or something like that. And so that took a lot of internal effort and debate to change. But what we did find was when there was money in newspapers, and this is something Stephanie brought up, and I should say, by the way, that Stephanie, I totally agree with you about the way The Guardian takes arts and culture seriously. It is an actual shining example of what can be done, even with limited resources. But when people took it seriously, it was because there was money available and there was money being made. So there was money available to spend in the arts. And so people then thought that we might have some people on staff who could do this. And so you might have two or three people covering the arts or culture within the organisation. And something, an example at the Herald, there were maybe a dozen or so people who would be covering those things from within the paper. And we still had freelancers augmenting that, but it happened internally. But as Stephanie said, when things need to be cut, the pages that get cut first are the arts coverage, and within that, the first things that get cut within arts are usually music. The last things that are cut are literature, which is possibly because the people who don't really engage with arts but run the organisations know that that's important. They don't know why, because they don't read mostly, but they know it's important. But the first things that are cut are arts. The first things that are cut then are the arts journalists, and when the arts journalists go, as happened in large numbers in Fairfax 3-4 years ago, they're not replaced. They're replaced in part by freelancers, and the freelancers are the easiest to get rid of when the next cut needs to happen, because they're not there, they don't care.
Yeah, that's a great summary. Absolutely great summary, Bernard. And I think what's happening at the moment is it's just so clear that journalism is in massive strife. So, you know, all the research that's been coming out in recent years, you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know just from being a casual reader of the news. Journalism, news is in serious strife. And now the coronavirus has just, for many organisations, has just been the nail in the coffin. You know, we've seen all these local and regional newspapers, news outlets in particular, either closing down completely or just going into suspended animation. And more on the way, you know, from Rupert Murdoch's titles through to Australian Community Media to everything else, you know. So the fact that journalism and news media is under real financial pressure and in a state of crisis, coupled with the fact that, as Bernard says, arts journalism tends to get hit first, this is a real problem, unfortunately, at the moment.
Now, it's not all bleak news. In May, The Age and Sydney Morning Herald announced places for 5 emerging culture critics. This move was made possible due to support from the Copyright Agency and the Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism and Ideas. The twist to this story is that this morning, in an incredible show of leadership, 2 of those critics gave up the role because all 5 were white. Bec Kavanagh and Jack Calil tendered their resignations to allow space for non-white writers. Stephanie, can I ask you, what does this tell us about the role of culture writers in society?
I think it's been pretty clear over the last few weeks, particularly in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests all around the world and things like that, that when there is a stirring of political sentiment about something important, it has a knock-on effect in the arts. And the arts is one of those places that is currently in the grip of a bit of a reckoning around diversity, around the representation of different cultural backgrounds, not just in the media, but also in books and in film and in theatre and all of that. And so I think what we're seeing with this critics program is another kind of part of that. So the idea that we need more critics of colour to review, to analyse, to work on products, cultural products by people of colour and also by people not of colour too, create a more diverse ecosystem, cultural ecosystem for everybody that takes into account the multiplicity of perspectives in the world, has kind of come to a point on this particular issue. Now, all of the critics that were, as I understand it, nominated by the Sydney Morning Herald and the Copyright Agency for that fellowship were white, and these two critics have decided to take on board a lot of feedback that was made very public about the dissatisfaction in the community more generally at this decision. And they kind of took it upon themselves to say, okay, we're going to step aside. Now, that is a really admirable thing to do. They're basically making themselves, sacrificing what is a very difficult career opportunity to give up, right, like to work with a major newspaper with funding to produce a series of critical pieces that will be read by a lot of people. And to say this is going to go to somebody of colour. Now, whether that will actually change the structure that put those people in that place in the first place, that is the question that I have about that. I think it's an admirable thing for them to do, and they've made a really big statement by doing it. And they've made a material sacrifice in the sense they've given up income and they've given up a career opportunity. I don't know that that will necessarily change that structure in the long run, but I'm really keen to see what happens.
Bernard, when you started out, the newsrooms were even wider than today. What's your reaction here?
That was so wise. But not just wide, but also in the Sydney context, very eastern suburbs, North Shore, inner west. It was interesting to be someone from the western suburbs as well as someone brown in a newsroom like the Herald, which had the interest, at least in medium, middle-level management in covering and being interested in those areas, but didn't actually have the practical means to do it or the support from top levels. Certain editor-in-chief at the time was of the view that people who were black, people who were poor, people who were odd-looking from the western suburbs weren't really appropriate for the Herald. But within that, there was this environment where people wanted to change. They just didn't know how to do it, and they didn't realise that it would actually involve giving up something else. And that's, I think, what today's example is, these resignations from it, is showing, that there isn't any way for this to happen without somebody giving something up. And it doesn't mean that everybody has to be booted out if you're not a person of colour or of whatever other element is needed to boost it, but just that we need to recognise that something has to give elsewhere. It's not just going to rise with the tide.
Sasha, if I can go back to the fact that these writers were funded by philanthropy, is this a way forward for culture critics, and is one of the advantages that there will be a higher level of public scrutiny of appointments?
Oh, look, philanthropy is definitely an option. Australia's not all that good at it. I think we need to look at a whole range of potential sources to boost journalism, public interest journalism, arts journalism, and philanthropy should be in the mix somewhere, but I don't think we can rely on it too heavily. Look, something else that I'd want to add to this discussion is ABC Comedy, I was reading, is going as well, and I haven't heard very much discussion about this. And clearly that doesn't mean that all the comedy shows will disappear, but I'm sure that some of them will. And to me, one of the great successes of the ABC of recent years has been the way it's done comedy. And particularly under Mark Scott, it became this almost the best thing about the ABC for a while there. And it also became really diverse, you know. So there was a real effort that you could see that in the comedy the ABC was producing, there was black comedy, There's Please Like Me. I'm just trying to think. Get Kraken was one of the, you know, really controversial in a sense with his final episode. You know, pushing the bounds, particularly in regards to diversity. And so these sorts of things, I actually worry that when we're seeing journalism being cut as we are in a state of crisis, that we've gone backwards in diversity terms. So yes, things have improved over the years. You know, it wasn't as white as it hasn't been as white and male dominated as when I started in and when Bernard started. But I think with the cuts, it's getting worse. You know, newsrooms are getting whiter again. That's my sense.
So this is a huge issue, and I feel like we haven't even touched the surface with all there is to talk about the role of culture and arts in society and journalism in that. However, we have to end, so let's end by doing what you all do so well. 2020 has been a difficult and unusual year. What in the Australian cultural media landscape has been inspiring you this year? Stephanie, if I can come to you first.
I think there's been a lot of generosity from arts journalists and from arts companies towards their audiences. I think everyone in the arts was kind of hit with this, oh God, how do we continue to make culture when all of the rules by which we used to make it have just gone out the window? And people have been responding in really creative ways. I do think that, you know, some of the things that we thought would be taking off 2 months ago are not going to stick around. But I do think that there has been a lot of willingness to make sure that this stuff continues, that people are as entertained and as challenged as they ever were, despite all of the obstacles towards, you know, communication and life, normal life as we knew it, that still exist.
Great answer. Sasha, can I come to you?
Yeah, of course. Look, one thing that I think is potentially really positive is something I mentioned earlier, the ACCC mandatory bargaining code. So there is a real potential there that some money will flow out of this mandatory bargaining code to public interest journalism and to arts journalism, and that would be a wonderful thing. So this is something that is going on at the moment. There is a draft code that will be delivered at the end of July. So we'll see more and know more then. But, you know, I'm optimistic. The whole ACCC process over the past 2 years of investigating the impact of digital platforms has been really impressive from where I stand. And so, yeah, I'm really optimistic about where that might go.
Bernard, can I ask you last, what in the Australian cultural media has been inspiring you this year?
I think the fact that there's a community, when it's a community of arts creators and arts providers, have realised that this is something that needs to be done together, that you can't depend on the organisations who wield the power or have the space to do it. The collective spirit, I think, is one thing that seems to have come through quite strongly this year. The other thing is one that is more hopeful than any genuine basis, and that is that deprivation of arts and culture in our lives through the past 3 months. I'm hoping that might actually bring to the front of people's minds what it is that they're missing out on. Something I said before about that we don't really value a lot of these things until they're not there. I'm hoping that the absence of art and culture in the ways that we were used to over the past 3 months and probably for some time yet will focus people's minds, and that includes ABC Cuts, will focus people's minds on what we value and what we want in our lives. And maybe that will generate something more than just a tweet or a letter to the editor.
On that hopeful note, I'd like to thank Stephanie Convery, Dr. Sasha Molitoritz and Bernard Zuhl for being on The Fourth Estate. And thanks for listening to The Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded on the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you're subscribed to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics and a few things in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. Thanks to my producer, Anthony Dockrell. My name's Chrysanthi Giotis. Thanks for listening.